I'm speaking with Mustafa Hanaway, who is a member of the International Solidarity Movement and also the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty here in Toronto. So maybe just to begin, let's go back to your trip to Palestine over last year, and maybe you could explain to us a bit about the work you were doing while you were there in Jenin.
I was in Palestine from July 2003 to November last year, and most of the work that the International Solidarity Movement does is supporting nonviolent direct action against the occupation, with the goals of mitigating some of the violence, but also supporting Palestinian resistance in the areas that we do work in the West Bank, in the Gaza Strip. And most of the work that we do fluctuates because we're Palestinian-led. So a lot of the times, you know, we have set campaigns, one of them being the Freedom Summer Campaign, which focuses around the freedom of movement of Palestinians within the West Bank, as it's a form of collective punishment through a series of checkpoints, road closures, roadblocks, curfews, all these things. And the major one has now been the wall, which the first phase was built in Jenin and outside of the Jenin region, cutting off more than 27 villages' access to their farmland, as well as annexing some 15 villages, the entire population of the village. So most of the work focused in the Freedom Summer Campaign was focused around supporting Palestinian resistance to the apartheid wall. And has it been the one of the largest barriers, not within just the West Bank and those living inside 48, but it's a barrier, it's not just a literal barrier, but it's a barrier that divides Israelis from the rest of the Arab world. It's a barrier that says we are the ruling class. We are, you know, if this is going to be an apartheid between the haves and the have-nots throughout the Arab world. And essentially, that wall was just such a symbol of Israeli policy towards Palestinians that, you know, it has to be resisted. And also, not just on the long term, but on a daily level, where Palestinians can't go to their olive trees, where Palestinians can't take their children to the hospital because that wall has now divided a village by half, or the wall has taken the school, but on the other side remain all the children. So actions that we have taken against the wall have been protests with Palestinian farmers, but one of them was in July 28th. It was during the demos against the World Trade Organization in Montreal, and it was kind of timed accordingly to do that, to kind of the Palestinians in the village of Anin, who had lost the most land from the wall, wanted to organize not just a demo against the wall, but to actually take direct action and tear down as much of the wall as they can, using internationals to support that, knowing that the violence that would inflicted on them would be too high if they just went alone to try to tear down the wall, that they would probably lose lives and people from the village would probably be killed. So we supported that action, which was probably one of the peak actions in the Freedom Summer Campaign. Around 500 Palestinians, 60 internationals, and some 30 Israeli anarchists marched against the wall, rushed open the gate, tore down parts of the wall. And because of that, the Palestinians in Anin, it was to a degree symbolic, as they put jeeps on that part of the wall directly after. But Palestinians were allowed to get to the land, access their land, as much as that was only part of a Band-Aid solution, but it was part of that political mobilization, that resistance against the wall. And also, you know, now the story of Anin is, you know, told throughout the world. When people talk about the wall and people talk about horrible examples of villages being affected by the wall, Anin is now one of those. So their struggle that was invisible is now clearly visible against the wall. The other work that we had done, a major component of the International Solidarity Movement, is what we call response work, or when curfew actually takes place or the military invades, most of the time, for no reason, it's quite arbitrary, we go out there and we support those who are trying to break curfew, those who are trying to get to the hospital, those who are trying to cross checkpoints, those who are trying to get to school. So a lot of the times that means, you know, being with them and standing with them, whether it be negotiating, whether that means putting your body on the line, that work is done and has gained ISM a lot of credibility within Palestinian communities who distinguish us now from, you know, just observers or just, you know, independent journalists, that people see as ISM as being a functional part of the Palestinian, you know, resistance to the occupation. And what distinguishes us from a lot of the NGOs that are there is that ISM isn't based along lines of charity, that it's based on solidarity. We're not there to aid or we're not there to, you know, out of pity, but we're there because internationals need to be there, because it's a responsibility against the occupation and to support the struggle against the occupation. We're not the ones who are dictating the resistance, we're only there to support it. And that means, you know, from the day-to-day to the actions, you know, to even supporting the right to any form of resistance that Palestinians seem fit. So one of the actions that we had done during, kind of not during the campaign, but during curfew, which happened in Jenin for 2.5 months while we were there, was a lot of the times they would target the baker. They would target the bakeries because they played an essential role in daily lives of everybody. Without the bakery, people would starve, and curfew would actually have a tremendous effect on people, as it already does on the economy. No one's allowed to leave their house. No one's allowed to go and get food. Food is not allowed to be delivered. So even basic subsistence is completely arbitrary, and people actually don't have a right to under curfew. Sometimes they'll lift up the curfew once a week for maybe 3 hours and then reinvade the city. So for 2.5 months, malnutrition levels, people's access to food was completely denied. So people took action. People, you know, this wasn't coming from us. A lot of individuals would go out, you know, with bread carts, or the bakery would open really early, closing the doors so that the army won't invade or the army won't know. But when the army find out, they'd actually be raided and then be arrested, almost as if they were a security threat. A lot of the times when the jeeps roll through the city during the day to enforce curfew, a lot of the times they're looking for people with grocery bags, and they'll arrest you and they'll put you in administrative detention, or they'll keep you temporarily detained. So a lot of the times that's the purpose of curfew. It's collective punishment, has no security purposes whatsoever, and it's just another form of aggression towards the Palestinian people. And so one of the actions that we had come up with the bakers was to begin to take a real direct action around the access to food. So the idea was, one, you know, internationals would stand with the baker every single morning under curfew and would try to block the roads, would try to resist the soldiers from closing down the bakery. Another form of action, what we did was, with a lot of the kids and people that worked in the bakery, was to take out bread carts with banners draped, you know, that what does food have to do with security? What does bread have to do with curfew? And we would be with the bakers and we would go out on these bread carts and try to encourage people from the community to come out. And it was slow at first, you know, a lot of the times it'd be like one by one. People would come out and they would buy bread. And then at one point, you just saw this whole street fill up with people defying curfew, just hundreds of people coming out. One, because they needed bread, but because they no longer wanted to be prisoners of their own home. They wanted to be out on the street because it was their city, it was their right. And so because of that action, we were able to, one, to provide access to food, not actually deliver food. I mean, that was the goal, was the right of access to food, not being a charity and buying food and delivering it, but having people resist, you know, and supporting that resistance for the even the simplest thing of getting bread. And so it was quite successful, and we would do it daily, and it was sustainable. And by the time, you know, we'd have whole routes set up throughout the city with the kids and with the bakers, and essentially became one of the most effective actions that we had taken in Jenin, and continues to this day, you know, the support of internationals to take those actions on. And it even grew quite a bit to produce, you know, where people are now taking ISMers along with them and fruit carts and vegetable carts. So, I mean, that was one of the best actions to show solidarity as well as dealing with the question of charity as well. And, you know, what does that mean for solidarity activists? You know, that blurry line between charity and solidarity. So in a way, that was really effective. The other type of work that we did do prisoner solidarity to a degree, where we would go with families and escort them to the trials of their children who were being held in military courts. We would also stay in homes or in places that were set to be demolished. One of those was the radio station that was always under threat of military intervention or being raided by the Israeli Defense Forces. So we had stayed so long term with the radio station, we purchased our apartment next to it. So that was kind of the breadth of the work that internationals do. The other campaign that's actually coming up is the Olive Harvest campaign, which we organized in Jenin and outside of Jenin, and escorting farmers to their land that's under threat by settlers or settler violence, as well as a lot of these what they call settler roads or yellow plate roads only are used to divide entire villages. So the idea, you know, is to block them and to get Palestinians across so that they can get to their farmland. And what people don't know, a lot of these roads or part of this project of settler roads is actually through the Canadian Highway Corporation, which is based here in Toronto, which is building this huge Israeli highway that's connecting all of these settler roads and they're profiting, you know, largely $1.2 billion off of this project. So, I mean, it's one of those ways of connecting the occupation in Palestine to people here and what they can do here. And so actions against those roads have also been key. And now, I mean, that's kind of the basic work that we would do in Palestine. You know, I can go on about other things that would happen and, you know, about roadblock removals, but as long as we, you know, the work, as long as it's a form of a solidarity and as long as it's Palestinian led, most of the time ISMers will take that on, because it's that's the nature of the solidarity.
It's interesting that you brought up the issue of the roads corporations, kind of one example of how what's happening in Palestine is directly linked to what's happening here. Of course, with what we're looking at with the Palestinian refugees throughout the world, but many of them here in Canada, is also another example of how issues there are heavily linked to issues here in Canada. So that kind of brings us to the next thing I wanted to speak about, was the work that you're doing with the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty and Immigration with the refugees here.
In terms of the Immigration Committee of OCAP, a lot of it's based on working with those who are the most marginalized, those, you know, in the society who under themselves are under a form of, you know, occupation or themselves under a form of apartheid. A lot of times refugees, immigrants are within apartheid here within the Canadian state, where they have no access to housing, they have no access to education, where people of non-status can be legitimately targeted by the state. And also, as part of this growing since September 11th, the war of terrorism, right, that Canada has much been a part of with these security certificates, its attacks on Muslim immigrants and refugees and Palestinians being a major part of that, being targeted by the Canadian state, being deported, and also it's linked to Canadian policy, right? Canadian policy, not just at home, but abroad, in terms of if the Canadian state were to actually recognize the Palestinians as legitimate refugees, that would mean they would have to recognize the violence of the occupation. That means they would have to recognize Israel as being in the wrong. And because the links are there, that Canada's agenda is closely linked to Israel's agenda. I mean, even in terms of the refugees outside of that come from the West Bank or Gaza, but the refugees in Jordan, for one example, why would Canada actually say that Jordan's in the wrong in terms of interrogation of Palestinian refugees, the abuse of Palestinian refugees, the fact that clamping down on the right of dissent of Palestinian refugees, when Canada has been supporting the Jordanian state by actually training those police officers through the RCMP? So the fact is, those agendas are absolutely linked. And so the fact is, to fight apartheid there, it's necessary to fight apartheid here and to fight with those who are the most marginalized and show solidarity to those who are resisting on a day-to-day. And I think that's a lot of the work that OCAP Immigration does through its direct action casework, through, and it's, and the fact it's not charity. It is a way of showing solidarity with immigrants and refugees, and it's a way of taking direct action to win those with those communities. And now with the Palestinian community here in Toronto has been very key for Montreal. It's been going on a long time, but for us it's just started and becoming an issue. And slowly immigrants and refugees from the Palestinian community are coming out and are wanting to stand up and are wanting to resist and are just saying that they're facing apartheid, that they have to resist the immigration system here, and that the Canadian government is supporting Israel. So I mean, all of those agendas are linked. And so in terms of our role as activists, we can go there for a very short time, or we can even go there for a very long time. But until we fight against apartheid here, then we'll never be able to show that's real solidarity with people over there in Palestine resisting the occupation, because it's from here those policies are driven. So a lot of the times, every time that we do a direct action case around a Palestinian refugee, it is in solidarity with Palestinians fighting in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And so that's why it's absolutely necessary to organize with that community and to resist Canada's policies and Canada's role, not just in Palestine, but to refugees here. In terms of other immigrant refugee communities supporting their work as well, Project Threadbare has been a huge part of that, where it came around the 24 Pakistani and Indian men who were arrested under what the RCMP called Project Thread, targeting them as supposed, terrorists linked to Al-Qaeda, but essentially were just Pakistani students who had come over and who are now being deported and are facing extreme repression back home. And so now that there are only 7 men left, it's absolutely vital that if we're trying to fight the war abroad, then it's absolutely necessary to fight the war, to fight against the war at home, and that means supporting people who are left in Project Threadbare. And I think that's where OCAP Immigration comes in, and I think that's the role OCAP comes in, where it's not just fighting, the municipal government, it's not just fighting the provincial liberals, but it's also taking a very clear stance in terms of solidarity with people's struggles against imperialism, against colonialism, everywhere, by taking seriously our role here within the Canadian state.
Now, just going back to the Palestinian refugees specifically here, how many Palestinian refugees are there roughly in Toronto, and what is their political status right now?
In terms of the numbers of Palestinian refugees, right now we're working with more than two dozen Palestinian refugees, and more and more. It's hard because there is no stats. But people say it's more, that it's more than Montreal, just due to the size of Toronto, due to the fact a lot of Palestinian immigrants and refugees come from Windsor. So it's actually quite a sizable community, and it's only been as of recent trying to do the outreach and working with those refugees, and then turn organizing refugees that they know. And it's different geographically, Toronto, where a lot of immigrants and refugees don't live in one community, in one building. So there's a lot of, in Scarborough or in Mississauga. So a lot of that work is still trying to be done about figuring out how many Palestinian refugees are there exactly in the Toronto area. But people are estimating that there is as many, or if not more, than Montreal. And only as of recently have they been coming out. And in terms of their political status, some of them have failed their pre-removal risk assessment. Some haven't even had their hearings yet. Many of them are just in a status of limbo because they don't even have identification, right? Because they're stateless, where can they be deported to? To what country? If Jordan won't accept them, if Egypt won't accept them, if Lebanon won't accept them, then they kind of just remain here. One person who had just recently won his VIC case was due to that, because they couldn't deport him anywhere he's able to remain. But a lot of the times, a lot of the cases that we meet, they vary from not even having their hearings yet to being underground or failing the pre-removal risk assessment, which just proves Canada's bias to Palestinian refugees.
Where do the refugees themselves, where do they want to see this campaign go? In what direction? What steps do they want to be taking now?
In terms of Toronto, a lot of the refugees, there's a variety of things that they want, but all of them, what unites all of them is that the right to remain within Canada, the right to have status, so the right to be granted permanent residency, and to become citizens, and to no longer be treated as, you know, as terrorists, but be treated with dignity. So a lot of them, it's a political fight around the myths of Palestinians and around the tackling the racism that goes behind the Canadian state and the Canadian immigration policies, as a lot of people have faced in the Immigration Refugee Board with certain judges or certain people who hear Palestinian cases who've denied them all just on the basis of the type of racism that's being conducted through the IRB, as not recognizing the occupations, not recognizing the Palestinians as a people, to say that they can go back to Jordan, that they can go back to the refugee camps in Lebanon, and not actually recognizing those conditions. So their goals are, one, to make it visible the conditions of Palestinian refugees, not just here, but everywhere, but also to be able to fight, to be able to remain landed immigrants within Canada.
Maybe just to wrap up, I kind of want to try to find some sort of a link between the work that's being done on the ground in Montreal and in Toronto with the refugees, and how that relates to the Palestinian self-determination movement as a whole. Maybe you could elaborate a bit on that link, if there is one.
A lot of the times within the Palestinian self-determination movement, what Israel's been really good at has been dividing Palestinians and dividing their demands. So a lot of the times they'll divide the refugees in the camps in Lebanon and in Jordan to the demands of Palestinians within West Bank and the Gaza within the occupied territories. And then those people are divided between Palestinians who are living inside, you know, occupied 48 Palestine. And then you have the whole question of the diaspora. So the fact is, a lot of the times, the goal, or Israel's been successful at or attempting at, is dividing Palestinians in that manner. And then trying to pin Palestinians against each other, saying that the people in West Bank and Gaza, they just want a two-state solution. That the refugees in the camp are just fighting for Lauda and the right of return and for a one-state solution, and that the Palestinians inside, you know, 1948, just because they have more privileges, are pinned against everybody else. And then there's the diaspora, which has been left out of the political process. And I think the organizing of the refugees self-organizing in Montreal and now in Toronto, and hopefully more nationally, only puts back the question of unity and of unifying those demands, that yes, we're fighting for status here, but at the same time, we do believe Lauda is a sacred right, and the right of return is a right that cannot be broken, and is a right that is throughout all those Palestinian communities and through those differences, and that the struggle against occupation and apartheid is everywhere, and that Palestinians are involved within that political process. And so some of those links have been endorsements from actual Palestinian communities inside the occupied territories, inside the camps, and making the links through events such as, you know, the Alauda concert that just recently happened in Toronto, and the fact that it brought the refugee communities here from Toronto who are fighting around their specific demands to be granted status, the fact that it brought people from inside of 48 to here to talk about the right of return it was kind of a unifying event that made the links between all the different aspects of the Palestinian self-determination struggle in a very real way, in a very tangible way, and to see that there's different fronts on the right, on the self-determination struggle, and that they're all linked and that they shouldn't remain divided. And so I think that this only creates only more of a springboard for more participation within the self-determination struggle in Palestine, that the diaspora is not outside of that. The refugees living here are not outside of that struggle, but very much still a part of that struggle through their own struggle to be granted status here in Canada.
We've been speaking with Mustafa Hanaway of the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty and the International Solidarity Movement. Thank you, Mustafa.
Thank you.